Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege and pleasure to welcome to the Salyer Report a very special person, somebody I always love to talk with. And her name is Lucy Commissar. She's the publisher of the Commissar Report. And she is something very special these days, and that is a real investigative reporter. Not only a real investigative reporter, but one who has grappled with, really understood, and has the intellectual fearlessness and capability to look at the sort of very complex international financial arrangements, including the offshore financial system, something which for many reporters has been a mystery to them for years. And Lucy has really dug in and unpacked it. So I'm very pleased she could join us today. So Lucy Commissar, welcome to the Salyer Report.
Thank you very much.
Well, you've accomplished a great deal. You've written many books. You've written many articles. You now publish your own wonderful website, The Commissar Report, on
The Commissar Scoop.
Oh, that's right. It's The Commissar Scoop, that where you cover all of your different coverage, including the offshore system. But where I would love to start is how someone with your background and many interests got so focused on the offshore system and really developed a specialty in covering it.
It's because in the 1980s, I was interested in movements for democracy going on around the world. And I went to many of those countries. For example, I went to the Philippines, and I was there when Marcos was overthrown. I went to Zaire when Mobutu was in charge. I went to Haiti when a successor to the Duvalier group, General Avril, was in charge. And every time I talked to oppositionists in those countries, they all said, the dictator has looted the country and the money is in Swiss banks. And I didn't know about the Swiss bank system. I'd heard it referred to. If you went to a thriller in the movies, the bad guy had hidden money in Swiss banks. But it never really stuck with me. But I thought, I am talking to people in different continents, in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, and they're all talking about Swiss banks. Something is going on here, and I'd better find out about it fast. So I began to investigate for myself what Swiss banks were all about. And I discovered that the system, which was supported by the Western financial powers and the Western banks who participated, allowed individuals and companies to set up secret bank accounts so that they could hide the money flows there. And it could be because they didn't want to pay taxes, so they were hiding money that would make profits and everything would be hidden in the secret account. Or maybe they were criminals. Maybe they were drug or arms traffickers. Sometimes they were intelligence agencies, and they all liked this secret system. And the first time I wrote about it was when there was an effort to get the Swiss to move to make the money that Jews had hidden in Swiss banks available to their survivors. The Swiss had said, you can put your money here in the 30s, you can put your money here and it will be safe. But then when it came time to give it back to those who had the right to have it, they suddenly said, well, we don't really know where it is, we can't find it. And in the U.S., a number of controllers, city and state controllers, said, we have our money in banks connected to the Swiss system, and we're going to pull all our billions of dollars out unless the Swiss government does something about finding this money. And lo and behold, the Swiss found the money that they couldn't find before. So when this happened, I wrote an op-ed that was in the LA Times, and I said, you know, it's not only about the hidden Jewish money. The Swiss banking system, the secret banking system, is about many other things, and people ought to be aware of that, and it's a really serious question. So that was the first time I think anybody had written about something like that. It was about 1997. So we're talking almost 20 years ago, 18 years ago.
And so let's look at the So go ahead.
Then I thought, because a little naively, I thought, oh, I have just discovered something really very interesting, and I'm sure I'd like to know about it. I had written something for the Wall Street Journal about my Stasi file, because I had a Stasi file, because I'd written about the dissidents, and one of the editors was interested because they loved to write articles that were bashing the communists. So I somehow came in just on their wavelength to write this article about my Stasi file. Then I thought, after I had, quote, discovered the offshore system, let's go back to the same editor, and I did, and I said, I'd like to write an op-ed about this offshore system. It's very, very important. And he asked for I wasn't going to write up, you know, a huge take on it. I had to focus on something. And I gave him all kinds of ideas about the system and how terrible it was. And he kept on shooting down all these different ideas about tax evasion, about how corporations can hide their profits. He finally came into agreement on a piece about how drug traffickers in one of the Caribbean islands, they were using an offshore system and how the corrupt government was facilitating that, and they printed that. Of course, sometime later, I thought, Lucy, you were very naive. The people who read the Wall Street Journal are using offshore bank accounts to hide their taxes and to finagle the profits and records of their companies. And did you really think the Wall Street Journal was going to run an op-ed against it? I had the same experience with the magazine of the Council on Foreign Relations, which I'd been a member of since 1994. I still am. And the editor was interested in the general subject and gave me an assignment to do it. And his name is Hogan, by the way. He's no longer an editor there. He was there for many years. He'd been an editor, I guess, of the Daily News in New York. And so I turned in this very extensive article about the offshore system. And then I got a call from his secretary saying, where should we send the kill fee? And I thought, well, this is odd. This editor never told me that there was anything wrong with the article. He never suggested that I should make some changes. He never even personally said, well, we think we don't want to run it. It was the rudest turndown I've ever gotten in my life. And I realized, because I'd been a member just for a few years, since 94, and this was in the late 90s, the people, the Council on Foreign Relations, the members, it's overweighted with bankers and businessmen. And Lucy, you have the same problem as you did with the Wall Street Journal. These people don't really want to know the truth about the offshore system. So this is a real problem. The powers that run the media, that run big think tanks like the Council on Foreign Relations, they like this system because the people those are the tax dodgers, and those are the individual and corporate tax dodgers. Those are the intelligence agencies that like to use this to do nefarious jobs. So little by that article, by the way, got published by Dissent Magazine, which is a social democratic magazine, and they didn't seem to have a problem with it. But it took me a while to understand that I had really gotten into something which, in my initial naivete, I was not aware that this powerful system is not just used by some drug traffickers and some funny people in an island in the Caribbean, which the Wall Street Journal thought that was okay to write about. It's really used by very powerful interests in the United States. That's why it has been so hard to deal with it.
Right. So let me just point out, because you mentioned the problem with the article in Council on Foreign Relations. You're the founder of the International Tax Justice Network.
And, there were probably about 30 of us at the founding meeting, which was in Porto Alegre in 2003.
And you're the author of its report, Citigroup, A History and Culture of Tax Evasion. Now, when you wrote that report, Bob Rubin, former Secretary of the Treasury, was probably head of the Executive Committee of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yes, it's very, of course.
So if you look at the executive committee of the council, which I've done several times, you know, basically you're talking about people whose institutions are deeply dependent on the offshore financial system.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, Citibank is a very dirty bank, and that's what my report showed. This was done, sponsored by the Tax Justice Network, to present at a meeting of the counter Davos, Davos being the big meeting in Davos, Switzerland, held every January of the people in power, of, you know, of the what people will call the ruling class, because
right.
they are. And so we had a counter Davos meeting, and we gave a prize. The president of Citibank was then a man named Prince. He was invited, but he didn't accept the prize. So I actually have the little trophy that was made on my dining table. So it was nice to keep.
So let's step back, because the offshore system involves many places. I once built a map of the Commonwealth and the basically the Crown and the Commonwealth and their entire offshore system. You've got the, obviously you've got the Swiss, but you've got, and now you've got Dubai and sort of the Middle East system, which has really exploded since after 9/11. And then of course you have the Commonwealth and the Crown, and that system is very extensive. So we're talking about many places.
Probably various reports have put it maybe at 70. But then you also have to consider the Americans and the British, the countries themselves. Think of New York and London. I once did an interesting story. I was in Buenos Aires, and I met an interesting guy who had set up he was a city official, and he had issued a ruling saying that any purchases of property in Buenos Aires had to be real people or real companies, and you could find out where they were. Because what was going on is, to avoid paying property taxes, people were setting up offshore accounts, buying the property in the name of the offshore account, not their own name, and so there were no records saying that they owned the particular property and they weren't paying their taxes. So this guy, who is a terrific guy, thought, let's not allow that anymore. If you want to buy property, you have to have a real name. Interestingly, the Brits are now concerned because so many Russian and other criminals have bought property in London that the property market is through the roof. And the properties are owned by people and companies that nobody knows who they are. And this is now happening in New York, that huge numbers of buildings, of the, you know, the very expensive buildings, a large proportion of apartments are often empty because they're being bought as a way to launder money. You buy, you have right. Money which is dirty money, and what are you going to do with it? You buy a $5 million apartment. Nobody lives there, but it's just your little bank. So I discovered in doing the research on Argentina, and I met a journalist who told me this story. He said that somebody had gone to, and this was filmed, by the way, so it was set up. Somebody went to a city banker in Buenos Aires and said, I have, my wife and I have a company, and we are selling it to some Brazilians, but we don't want to pay taxes on the money that they pay us for the company. And the city banker said, oh, don't worry at all, because we will open up an account for you at Citibank in New York City, and we will arrange for the payment to go directly from Brazil to your account in New York. And the American bank will, even though you own the account now and you're from Argentina, the American bank will not tell Argentina that you have a bank account there, which of course you're using to launder money. And this, they put this on TV in Argentina. It was a great moment. And the person that I interviewed wrote about it in the book he wrote about Citibank, history of Citibank in Argentina. So I used that in one of my stories. But immediately, there was a special section of Citibank that was supposed to be for wealthy individuals, and they closed the bank in Buenos Aires, And they moved all the accounts to Uruguay, which is also a money laundering place. But they just closed, and this guy no longer had the job, but it was indicated that he was paid off, so he didn't suffer too much, the guy who was a city banker who had arranged to do this. But the point really is it was shown that in New York City, Citibank was laundering money for people from other countries. Are they still doing it? I bet they are still doing it, because there are no rules that have changed that require the Americans to trade the information of who owns their accounts if the account owners are foreign, to give that information to the foreign country. So New York is also New York is offshore for people in other countries, including in this case Argentina.
How big would you say the offshore system is?
How extensive? You know, problem is when you don't know, people have guessed it all at, you know, the percentage of the super rich that have, how much money do they have in offshore? And I've seen something like it's 1/3 of their wealth, and it's trillions. It's many trillions. But the thing is that if something is secret, it's very hard to know what the numbers are. People are guessing because the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland has some sense of the money that banks have. Even they don't know who owns all this money, but there is some sense of what they have. We know that huge numbers of people or companies have bank accounts in Grand Cayman, and you know, like many, many times the number of companies and people that exist in Grand Cayman. So there are many judgments about where it is, but we don't really know. The real question, though, is why does it continue? So we sort of know the answer is the people in power want it to continue because it's their friends do it. I have another Council on Foreign Relations story. One of the members there, who's a guy in the finance business, well-known, nice guy, like him a lot. And when I have gotten to be known there when there are meetings and invited speakers, I very often ask a question about offshore. People now expect that I will do that. And at one point, after I asked a question about offshore to a guest, this fellow came up and said, "Lucy, but don't you understand? The taxes are too high." This nice guy was basically admitting to me that he probably had an offshore account because the taxes are too high. Well, the answer is, in a democracy, if you think something is wrong, you get together with other people and try to get your representatives to change it. You don't break the law because you disagree with the law. But I think that's the problem. The real answer was said to me by Robert Morgenthau, who used to be the district attorney of New York. And I had interviewed him for that article that ran in the Wall Street Journal about the little drug trafficking island in the Caribbean, which is the thing that they thought was the most important. Well, you know, how do you deal with this? He said, all you have to do is say that an American banks will not accept wire transfers from any banks connected to the offshore system. He said, if you cannot move your money from Grand Cayman to New York, the banking system there is over in a heartbeat. The Americans already have done this for other reasons. For example, it names some banks in North Korea. American banks are not allowed to accept transfers from these banks in North Korea. It names some banks in Syria. So the U.S. Treasury already, without even going to Congress, so many of whose members represent the people with the money that like to keep it hidden, but the U.S. already has, for security reasons, the Treasury has the ability to do this. Well, I think it's a big security problem if drug traffickers and terrorists and tax cheats can use the offshore system to the detriment of our country. That's a major security problem. There's no reason why the Treasury Department today, cannot do this and end the offshore system. And, of course, if the other major powers should do it as well, but if the Americans took the lead and said, if you can't move your money, because you see, the dollar is an international currency. Suppose the Germans The euro is not an international currency. It's a very important currency, but a lot of trade in the world gets denominated in dollars. So that trade denominated in dollars, the money digitally flits through New York. In fact, this is Morgenthau was very funny. He used to go after offshore crooks, and sometimes they had nothing to do with operation, any kind of activity or operation in the U.S. And he would say, well, they did this in dollars, and the dollars came through New York, and I'm in New York, I'm in charge, and therefore, and he actually won, put some people in jail, he won some cases. So as long as the dollar is an international currency, the most important one, you can do this. But they won't do this because the people that put into office the people with the power to do this are the ones that are using the system.
Well, if you step back and you look at both the offshore system and then you look at the dark pools, which is ways of trading and exchanging and settling securities which are now non-transparent, and then you look at the derivatives, is it fair to say we probably are watching larger and larger percentages of the financial system go dark?
That's right. And when things are done secretly, you don't know who the trader is. A lot of it is dirty money. And in fact, supposedly one of the reasons why Robert Rubin at a certain point didn't want to go after the offshore system was that there was a feeling that drug money was fueling the American economy. And one didn't want to make it more difficult for drug traffickers to move their money into the American economy. And I think that is, you know, without having definitive proof, it's certainly something that I had heard said, that it's dirty money fuels the Western economies. What are these people going to do with their money? There are just so many fancy houses they can buy. They do. It does fuel the real estate market, but then they want to invest it. They want to put it someplace, and it helps the economy. It doesn't help all the people who are suffering because of what the drug trafficking does to neighborhoods, but it helps the people who are concerned about raising stock prices in Wall Street.
Well, it's very interesting because if you look at Rubin's history as Secretary of the Treasury, he and his team were the people who engineered the nuts and bolts of the subprime mortgage lending and the reengineering the student loan industry so kids couldn't file bankruptcy or didn't have the normal consumer protections. So it was really, it was Rubin and Summers and Hawke who stripped essentially basic consumer protections from a lot of the debt world and made it possible to start to really bubble all these things. It was part of the strong dollar policy. And I remember I had a colleague in London who was writing about the extraordinary fraud going on in the American system being engineered from Treasury. And it was after Rubin left. So he was back at the Council on Foreign Relations. And he had dinner. He was seated next to him at dinner. And Rubin turned to him and looked at him and said, "You need to understand, there's nothing you can do about this. This is the way it's going to go."
Mm-hmm.
So this was a guy who clearly knew what he was doing. And, I've always called it a financial coup d'etat. But to me, the offshore system was absolutely essential to engineering the coup. I remember, go ahead.
He was on the various, he had positions at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was never a paid person there. He went to
right.
Citi, but I mean, these groups worked in tandem.
Right. Right. And it was very interesting because after Enron, I was looking, there was $4 trillion went missing from the federal government. I was part of a group of people who got the federal government to pass a law requiring audited financial statements. And then reports kept coming out every year explaining why they couldn't produce their audited financial statements. And that's how we found about, enormous amounts of money that went missing during that period, starting underneath Rubin. And we were able to document $4 trillion missing. And I was trying to figure out, okay, how are they laundering this money? Because that's a lot of money to launder. You can't launder that through pizza restaurants. So I was looking at Enron because all the people involved with the defense contractors who were running the information and payment systems at the agencies where the money was going missing were also in the board of Enron. So I thought, okay, well, maybe that's where Enron is getting these magical earnings that no one can describe. And when Enron went down, I think it was the Cayman Islands put out a press release saying, because Enron had over 700 subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands, they put out a press release about, I don't know, a month after it went down saying they would love to cooperate with the United States officials, but as of yet, they hadn't gotten a request to cooperate. And then a big part of that part at Enron, I think, was folded into a Swiss or sold to one of the Swiss banks, and there went the opportunity. And you thought, wow, that was quick.
Well, the U.S. now is making doing a lot of deals with Swiss banks in which they have to promise to do X, Y, Z, but they basically are letting them off the hook for paying money. I mean, it's basically pay to play. That is, pay to get out of trouble, and that is what is happening. So whenever they do these pay to play and plea bargaining, it means they never can get into the records. They never can do discovery. If you actually brought somebody to court, some company to court, bank to court, you could do discovery and find out what's going on. But in all of these cases, they don't do that. It's basically blackmail, I guess.
Well, there's another side to this, though, that concerns me, and that is, you know, I know a lot of perfectly legitimate people who have money in other jurisdictions because they're afraid of lawlessness by the U.S. government. There's plenty of examples of that. If you look at some of what's been done to the Swiss, I know lots of perfectly legitimate Swiss institutions and money managers who've really been bullied. In other words, you know, there's good guys and bad guys, and they're bullying a lot of good guys who aren't up to the tricks that the bad guys are up to. And so
the question whether or not some of these good guys can say, look, you don't have anything on us. But I think you're right. They'll figure out some way to make it difficult in some cases. Unless you come forward and say we're going to pay this, then they may go after you and you have to at least pay a lawyer to get out of the, you know.
What the U.S. is demanding of a lot of Swiss is that they give them all their data, including on clients and customers who have nothing to do with the United States. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mm-hmm. to protection of basic privacy says, I mean, the U.S. government, unfortunately, has a record of being very lawless in many instances. And you know, if I was a Swiss money manager, I would say, oh, you know, you want that information because you want to control this market share. And I don't trust you, you know, and I can't, as a matter of law, I can't compromise my client's privacy, including the, you know, the non-U.S. citizens. So yeah. It's a pretty tricky issue, and it gets very complicated. It also gets into something that you know a great deal about, which is the payment systems and clearance systems. You've written about SWIFT and the international clearing systems, and I think those are essential to understanding both the global financial system and the offshore system. But it's hard to, you know, it's a complicated topic. Maybe if you could describe a little bit about how the clearing and payment systems dovetail.
Yeah, what I wrote about was there was a company called Clearstream, which is an international clearinghouse. And I wrote about it because somebody who had worked there was fired after he saw some funny things going on. And one of his colleagues who also saw some funny things going on who was in good health was found dead. And there is a book called about Clearstream it's in French, Revelations by Ernest Backus and Denis Robert. And it talks about how the accounts, the feeling there were secret accounts and they were used to move money because What happens, a clearinghouse is for, generally is for stocks and bonds. That is, if you're selling something to somebody, you don't go to their office and say, here it is, here's a stock certificate, and you give me the cash, or give me the check. It goes, a clearinghouse, your broker moves what is really just a digital value, either representing the shares or representing money, into the clearinghouse account that the broker has, and the participating broker for the other side does the same thing. So they, one side then provides the digital shares, and the other side provides the cash. So this goes on both inside countries and also internationally. And I was writing about Clearstream, which is international. But there was a belief that some of these accounts were secret accounts, and they could be used for nefarious reasons, and particularly by intelligence agencies could use them. This is not something that's gotten much attention in the United States. It's gotten a little bit more attention in Europe. But based on the research I've done, I believe it is true. I know that the CIA was very interested in this when some of this was revealed, and there were some investigations. So it's an interesting story that I'm continuing to look at. But that's basically what I have written about. Some of the things I'm looking at, I haven't written about yet.
One of my favorite things on the homepage of the Commissar Scoop is your questioning of CIA Director John Brennan. And that was just this last March at the Council of Foreign Relations. Charlie Rose was doing an interview, and you asked him a question about the offshore system. And I just, I have to say it. Go ahead.
Well, the question was... I got up, I introduced myself. I said, how significant is the use by terrorist groups of the international offshore bank and shell company system, which is also, as we know, used by international criminal groups as well as tax evaders and all kinds of bad guys? And if it is significant, is this now the time to bring some transparency to the system by saying that non-transparent system banks and other institutions cannot have access to the American financial system? Of course, this is what I had indicated before was, you know, really the answer to deal with this. So what Brennan says, there are a variety of reasons why there needs to be, I think, greater transparency in some of the international financial activities that go on, terrorism being one of them. And he goes on and on about why this is really necessary. Terrorists have been enterprising, creative in terms of how they take advantage of the opportunities. The U.S. Department of Treasury and other institutions of the U.S. government have been very, very effective and successful working again with international partners to try to uncover and uproot this. That's a lie. He didn't say that. I'm saying that. But it is not just for tourism purposes. I never mentioned tourism. It's for organized crime, narco cartels, and others. But absolutely, we need to do more. More, they're not doing anything to deal with the offshore system. They're going after bank accounts that are hidden bank accounts. But there is a lot more, and it does have to do with terrorists and all kinds of corruption. And, of course, he just slid out of the question. He refused. Well, transparency, yes, but he wouldn't say whether transparency should be required of the offshore system. It couldn't exist without the complicity of the international financial system, which is very non-transparent. And the American banks often host correspondent accounts through which criminal offshore banks move clients' money. Now, most people don't know about this. A correspondent account in a bank in New York or L.A. or Chicago is an account owned by, in the name of, a bank in another country. And when its clients want to move money into the U.S., it collects that money and it goes into the correspondent account in some bank, could be Citibank or, Wells Fargo Bank. And from there, they, since they control the account, that bank, the foreign bank, can move the money any place it wants. So this is a way of laundering foreign money. Correspondent accounts, they were used a lot by Mexican drug traffickers, but they're used by everybody.
Right.
And there is no way that you can deal with this unless you know whose money is being moved. But they can move it, you know, in one bunch of cash. And, of course, they can say it's from our good client ABC. So the Treasury Department is not effective in dealing with this issue. And basically the big cases that it got, those were because they were whistleblowers. It was not anything that the Treasury figured out itself.
Well, it's interesting. I was helping a reporter who's investigating narcotics trafficking in the 90s, and at one point she sat down and had a lunch with a very high-level DEA leader who had recently retired, and he explained to her, he said, they batch all the wire transfers and they run through the New York Fed. They know where every penny is all the time. They could stop this, you know, anytime they wanted. And she called me and said, oh, this is really, you know, because what we're looking at is something that's very integrated in the system. It's it's an integral part of the global empire, if you will. And the empire is very financially dependent on it. And at the very top, the empire is running it. So, you know, and the reality is once you start digging into the offshore systems and the payment systems, you see that. Another thing you see, and I want to get back to your work with taxes. Another thing you see is that one of the things which is happening to sovereign governments all around the world is that as the offshore system has grown up, more and more money is basically protected by very complex schemes that make it technically legal from paying corporate taxes. So we watch the contribution of large corporations. As the large corporations get a larger piece of the general market share within a country, their contribution to taxes goes down. So their command of market share within a country goes up. At the same time, their contribution to taxes and paying for sovereign government cost goes up and up, and the externalities of their operations get hit to the citizens. Of course, the big one was $27 trillion of bailouts. But there's a fundamental flaw in the more they take, the less they contribute.
Yeah, well, the more they take, the more powerful they are. And they have these deals where, with the complicity of Europeans, they use countries such as Ireland and the Netherlands to move their money around, to make believe that what they're earning in this country, they're really earning in another country. I mean, it just seems to me that what you're earning is what you're earning, and that these accounting tricks should not be allowed. They should be basically unacceptable by the Treasury and by the IRS, but they're not, and they sometimes nibble around the edges, but they don't really deal with what is going on systemically. It's really a tough thing for the people in power who are put there by the people benefiting from the system to attack the system. They nibble at the edges, but they don't get to the heart of it. Basically, the offshore system should be abolished. There's no reason to have this kind of system of this secrecy, both corporate and both an individual. And even, you know, they make a big fuss about, in Europe now, there are agreements, and also between the U.S. and other countries, there are agreements for tax information sharing, that we will send information about the money held in our accounts by your citizens so you can see whether or not they're reporting it. It's illegal for them to have the account, but they have to report it on their taxes. Do you know what's missing that's never mentioned when these things are discussed? It's only about citizens. It's not about companies. Do you know how easy it is to set up an offshore company? You can actually do it in Nevada or Montana, and nobody knows who owns the company. So you set up a company in Montana, or Delaware, of course, is famous for that, but these new ones are making it even more non-transparent. So you set up that company opens a bank account in Switzerland or Grand Cayman or someplace, and so when there is a transfer of information, that's not included because that's not a person. It's a company. Remember, we were told that companies are people. Remember, companies are people? Not when it comes to sharing tax information. Companies are no longer people.
Well, it's interesting. If you look at the legal fees and sort of the licenses and other things you need to do that, you know, you need to have a certain amount of resources to play that game. It's not like, you know, a city cop can do it because there's a certain overhead to get in the game.
You can do it on the internet. Just go on the internet and look for set up offshore company in Montana, and you can do it. It's not, you know, it's not that difficult. Most people probably don't have enough money to make it necessary to hide. A little complicated, but it's people have written articles about how easy it is to set this up, and it's not.
Right.
You don't have to hire a lawyer. You just have to go to a website and set it up. But the system is organized at various levels. So those are not for the big companies to use. Those are for mostly they tend to be, you know, doctors and dentists and people who get money independently and want to hide it. So very often those are the people that get caught when they do these kinds of things. You never get a Google or a General Motors or a very big company getting caught. They do the legal cheating because it's legal.
Right.
It's accepted. But, you know, when you buy the lawmakers, you make the laws.
Right.
And that happens. These things are legal because the people that use them are buying the people who make the laws.
I think, you know, I always ask, what can we do? And I think the most important thing we need to do is to understand and accept that this truly is sort of run top down. It's not an accident. It's not something we can't do anything about. You know, this is a way of accumulating power, and those in power want to keep it this way. And it works because that's what they want.
Increasingly, when I started writing about this, nobody was talking about offshore tax evasion. Now, increasingly, there is a lot of talk about offshore tax evasion. But what I haven't heard yet is the call for ending the system, not just catching this one or that one, for ending the system and doing what Morgenthau says is do not allow money from offshore venues to enter the financial system. That's really the answer to it. Until that gets said seriously, somebody like Senator Carl Levin, who retired and is unfortunately no longer in the Senate, he talked about this. He knows what the. It's not like they don't know what's going on. He had over a dozen hearings from the late 90s. He knows exactly, and people unless there's willful blindness. The people in power know exactly what is going on. But until the public begins to understand that you have to move from the tax evasion and they have to understand how much they are paying more or services are diminished because the people have the money and the companies don't pay the taxes, and then connect it more to the criminality and the way it affects people's lives. So I think and then they have to get to the system. So that's the one thing that is missing, making the connection between some individual problems and the whole offshore system. Until the system is changed, we're just squeezing the balloon at one end, and then it pops up and it's the other end.
So grossly oversimplified, this is what I believe. You know, you can squeeze money out of the onshore system, move it to the offshore system, but at some point, the trust breaks down in the onshore system, the infrastructure breaks down, and, you know, you've liquidated what can be liquidated, and it stopped working, including for the people who have their money in the offshore system. And so if you look at the anger about inequality, if you look at the deflationary sort of thing we're in, and if you look at the extent to which things don't work, the people in the offshore system can't get any returns on their investments because the fundamental global onshore economy has stopped working.
Well, they get it by stealing. I mean, whatever they get, I'm not running any benefits for the big corporations who use the offshore system to launder their profits, because that's what they do. They launder profits. It's money laundering is a phrase that's used to discuss how you move illegally acquired money through the system, the financial system. But profit laundering is how you move legally acquired money through the offshore system so you don't pay taxes on it.
Right.
So that's what we're talking about. So they're making the money, and I don't think that's the problem. The problem is they're sequestering it for their own uses.
Right, right. Well, Lucy, I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Solera Report. Can you just give us a minute or two of how we can follow your work, how we can support you? How do we stay in touch with Lucy Commissar and what she's writing about?
You could go on my website, and on the which is thecommissarscoop.com, thecommissarscoop.com, and you could subscribe, top left. I also, but the thing is, the stuff I do takes so much time that I don't put up stuff frequently. If you subscribe, you're not going to get inundated. And I also have a Twitter, at Lucy Commissar, but the same. Sometimes when I do Council on Foreign Relations meetings, that's pretty easy to put up because some of the people are so outrageous, like the CIA director. So it's pretty easy for me to put that up, and I often include the video because they have video if it's a public meeting, and I include that with the question and answer, and they're rather amusing. You can always contact me. My email is on the site, and if anybody that wants to send money, I'd be happy to give an address. But I don't even have – I should contribute on that, and I haven't done that.
You should.
I know. You're encouraging me to do that. There's Lucy Commissar at thecommissarscoop.com, and send an email, and I'll be glad to give whatever information is required to be the recipient of a donation.
Well, I think, there are very few people going at this. Sometimes I think, too, large scale international fraud, you're like a diamond drill bit. Because it takes such intellectual capacity and courage to go after this. It's complicated stuff. And to nail down some of the things you've nailed down, it takes enormous energy. I just don't know anybody who does it with your clarity and coherence. So I deeply appreciate your work. If there's anything we can do to support you, will you let us know?
I will.
Okay. And if you write another book, you have to let us know right away because we'll promote the
bejesus. I'm actually working on two.
Okay, just let us know.
Won't be tomorrow.
I know. Lucy, you have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.